was thrilled when Thomas Jefferson, who had twice resisted congressional commissions to join Franklin and Adams as a minister in Paris, finally relented and arrived there in August 1784. Jefferson was everything that Adams was not: diplomatic and charming, partial to France, secure rather than jealous, a lover of women and social gaiety with no Puritan prudishness. He was also a philosopher, inventor, and scientist, whose Enlightenment curiosity meshed perfectly with Franklin's. To make matters even better, Jefferson was fully aware of the darkness that infected Adams. James Madison had written him to complain that Adams's letters were a display of his vanity, his prejudice against the French court, and his venom against Dr. Franklin. Jefferson replied, "He hates Franklin, he hates Jay, he hates the French, he hates the English. To whom will he adhere?" Jefferson shared Franklin's belief that idealism and realism should both play a role in foreign policy. The best interest of nations, like men, was to follow the dictates of conscience, he declared. And, unlike Adams, he completely revered Franklin. More respect and veneration attached to the character of Dr. Franklin in France than to that of any other person, foreign or native, he wrote. And he proclaimed Franklin the greatest man and ornament of the age. When word spread a few months later that he was being tapped to replace Franklin, Jefferson gave his famed reply, "No one can replace him, sir. I am only his successor." Jefferson dined often with Franklin, played chess with him, and listened to his lectures about the loyalty America owed France. His calming presence even helped Franklin and Adams get along better. And the three men who had worked together on the Declaration now worked together at Passy almost every day through September, preparing for new European treaties and commercial pacts. There was, in fact, a lot that the three patriots could agree on. They shared a faith in free trade, open covenants, and the need to end the mercantilist system of repressive commercial arrangements and restrictive spheres of influence. As Adams, with uncharacteristic generosity, noted, "We proceeded with wonderful harmony, good humor, and unanimity." For both men and nations, it was a season of reconciliation. If Franklin could repair his relationship with Adams, there was even hope that he could do so with his son. "Dear and honored father," William wrote from England that summer, "ever since the termination of the unhappy contest between Great Britain and America, I have been anxious to write to you, and to endeavor to revive that affectionate intercourse and connection which, until the commencement of the late troubles, had been the pride and happiness of my life." It was a noble, gracious, and plaintive gesture from a son who, through it all, had never said anything bad about his estranged father, nor stopped loving him. But William was still a Franklin, and he could not bring himself to admit that he had been in the wrong, nor to apologize. "If I have been mistaken, I cannot help it. It is an error of judgment that the maturest reflection I am capable of cannot rectify. And I verily believe, were the same circumstances to occur again tomorrow, my conduct would be exactly similar to what it was." He offered to come to Paris if his father did not want to come to England, so they could settle their issues with a personal interview. Franklin's response revealed his pain, but it also offered some hints of hope. He began by saying he was "glad to find that you desire to revive the affectionate intercourse," and he even brought himself to add, "it will be agreeable to me." Yet he immediately segued from love to anger. "Indeed, nothing has ever hurt me so much and affected me with such keen sensations as to find myself deserted in my old age by my only son. And not only deserted, but to find him taking up arms against me in a cause wherein my good fame, fortune, and life were all at stake. You conceived, you say, that your duty to your king and regard for your country required this. I ought not to blame you for differing in sentiment with me in public affairs. We are men, all subject to errors. Our opinions are not in our own power. They are formed and governed much by circumstances that are often as inexplicable as they are irresistible. Your situation was such that few would have censured your remaining neuter, though there are natural duties which precede political ones." Then he caught himself. "This is a disagreeable subject," he wrote. "I drop it." "It would not be convenient," he added, "to have you come here at the present. Instead, Temple would be sent to London to act as an intermediary. You may confide to your son the family affairs you wish to confer upon with me." Then, a bit condescendingly, he added, "I trust you will prudently avoid introducing him to company that it may be improper for him to be seen with. Temple may have been William's son, but Franklin made it clear who controlled him." At 24, Temple had little of his grandfather's wisdom, but possessed a lot more of the normal emotions that bind families, even estranged ones. He had long been hoping, he wrote a London friend, to return there to embrace my father. On his visit to England, he nevertheless was careful to show fealty to his grandfather, even asking for permission before accompanying his father on a trip to the seashore. After a few weeks, Franklin began to fear that Temple might be forsaking him for his father, and he chided him for not writing enough. "I have waited with impatience the arrival of every post, but not a word." Among other things, Franklin complained, this was embarrassing him with those who kept asking whether he had heard from Temple. "Judge what I must feel, what they must think, and tell me what I am to think of such neglect." Of all the members of his family, Temple alone could cause such jealousy and possessiveness. For his part, Temple was thoroughly enjoying himself. He was treated as a celebrity prince, feted by the Royal Society, the Lord Mayor, and various ladies who held teas in his honor. He had his portrait painted by Gilbert Stuart, and a friend gave him a list of the best bootmakers and tailors, adding, "And when lewd, go to the following safe girls who I think are quite handsome." Temple was not able to resolve the issues dividing his father and grandfather, but he was able to accomplish another part of his mission, enticing Polly Stevenson to come to Passy. Now 45, she had been widowed for a decade, and her mother, Franklin's longtime landlady and companion, had died a year earlier. "She loved you with the most ardent affection," Polly had written when conveying the sad news. Franklin had written Polly that she must come see him soon, for he was now like a building that required so many repairs that in a little time the owner will find it cheaper to pull it down and build a new one. By the end of the summer of 1784, his letters had become even more plaintive. "Come, my dear friend, live with me while I stay here, and go with me, if I do go, to America." In early December 1784, many people converged on Passy and provided for Franklin during his final winter in France a most satisfying version of the hybrid families, real and adopted, he so loved to assemble around him. There to pamper him were Temple and Benny, Polly and her three children, Thomas Jefferson and other great minds, plus Mesdames Brion and Helvétius, along with their wonderful retinues. For a fragile moment, note Claude-Anne Lopez and Eugenia Herbert, his various families were almost in perfect poise, drawing closer in a network of goodwill of which he was the center. Polly was amused by Temple on first seeing him again in London after 10 years, and she joked with Franklin about how he had tried to keep the boy's lineage secret back then. "We see a strong resemblance of you, and indeed saw it when we did not think ourselves at liberty to say we did, as we pretended to be as ignorant as you supposed we were, or chose that we should be." That gave her an opportunity to chide them both a bit. "I believe you may have been handsomer than your grandson is, but then you never were so genteel." But close familiarity with Temple did not, except in his grandfather's case, necessarily breed fondness, and Polly became somewhat disenchanted with him after their arrival in Passy. "He has such a love of dress," she wrote a relative, "and is so absorbed in self-importance and so engaged in the pursuit of pleasure that he is not an amiable or respectable character." Benny, on the other hand, with the benefit of his Geneva education and natural eagerness to please, struck Polly as sensible and manly in his manner, without the slightest tincture of the coxcomb. He wore his hair like an English lad rather than a French fop, and with the simplicity of his dress retains a lovely simplicity of character. Temple might look more like Franklin, but Benny, who swam in the Seine, flew kites with a passion, took Polly on tours of Paris, and yet was ever diligent in his printing work, resembled him more in mind. Adieu. There were times, indeed many of them, when Franklin wrote of his inclination not to disrupt this little paradise, but instead to remain in France and die among those who so loved and pleased him. His gout and his kidney stones made the prospect of an ocean voyage something to dread, while the embers of his passions for the ladies of Paris were something he could still savor. In May 1785, he wrote a friend recalling one of his favorite old drinking songs. "May I govern my passions with an absolute sway, grow wiser and better as my strength wears away, without gout or stone, by a gentle decay." "But what signifies our wishing?" he asked. "I have sung that wishing song 1,000 times when I was young, and now find at 80 that the 3 contraries have befallen me, being subject to the gout and the stone, and not being yet master of all my passions." Nevertheless, when word reached him that month that the Congress had at long last accepted his resignation and that Temple was not being offered an overseas assignment, Franklin decided it was time to go home. From Passy he wrote Polly, who had returned to England, begging her to accompany him. He had taken the liberty of reserving a spacious cabin for her whole family. "You may never have so good an opportunity." For the time being, at least, she decided to stay in England. He sent word of his travel plans to his sister Jane, and explained, "I have continued to work until late in the day. 'Tis time I should go home and go to bed." Such metaphors had begun to creep into his writing, and he expanded on them to his friend David Hartley, who had helped him during his many negotiations. "We were long fellow laborers in the best of all works, the work of peace," he he wrote. I leave you still in the field, but having finished my day's work, I am going home to go to bed. Wish me a good night's rest, as I do you a pleasant evening. Adieu. The farewells at Passy were dramatic and tearful.
Every day of my life I shall remember that a great man, a sage, has wanted to be my friend,
Madame Brion wrote after their final meeting.
If it ever pleases you to remember the woman who loved you the most, think of me.
Madame Helvétius was not to be outdone.
Come back, my dear friend, come back to us,
she wrote in a letter dispatched to catch up with him as he boarded his boat. To each of his friends went a gift that was to become a relic. Cabanis got the hollow cane that magically stilled the waves, the Abbé Morellet a tool chest, an armchair, and his landlord Chamon a table that could be ingeniously raised and lowered. He also gave Chamon a bill for the improvements he had made to his apartments, including installing a lightning rod and fixing the chimney to cure it of its intolerable malady of smoke. To ease his travels to the port of Le Havre, Queen Marie Antoinette sent her personal enclosed litter, borne by sure-footed Spanish mules. Her husband, King Louis XVI, sent a miniature portrait of himself surrounded by 408 small diamonds. Franklin also exchanged gifts with Vergennes, who noted to an aide that the United States will never have a more zealous and more useful servant than Monsieur Franklin. On the day he left Passy, July 12th, Benny recorded in his diary, a mournful silence reigned around him, broken only by a few sobs. Jefferson had come to see him off, and he later recalled, the ladies smothered him with embraces, and on his introducing me as his successor, I told him I wished he would transfer these privileges to me, but he answered, you are too young a man. Franklin's plan was to cross the English Channel and then determine whether he felt he could endure an ocean crossing. If not, he would ferry back to Le Havre, and the Queen's litter, which waited there for word, would carry him back to Passy. As usual, however, travel was a tonic rather than travail for Franklin, and he turned out to be the only passenger not to get sick during the rough channel crossing. When they arrived in Southampton, he and his party went to visit a hot saltwater spa, where, he noted in his journal, he bathed in the springs and, floating on my back, fell asleep and slept near an hour by my watch without sinking or turning. There was one last dramatic scene to be played out, one last emotional moment, before he could set sail on his eighth and final crossing of the Atlantic. For 4 days he stayed at the Star Inn in Southampton, so that he could receive some of his old English friends and bid them a final farewell. Bishop Shipley came, along with his daughter Kitty. So did Benjamin Vaughan, his back-channel missions for Jay and Temple forgiven, who was preparing to publish a new edition of his friend's writings. There were grand dinners and celebrations, which he described in his journal as very affectionate. But the main person who had come to see him at the Star Inn got only a brusque mention in his journal. "Met my son, who arrived from London the evening before," Franklin noted. There was no reconciliation, no recorded tears or affection, just a cold negotiation over debts and property. Franklin had regained full control over Temple by then, and he drove a hard bargain on his grandson's behalf. He insisted that William sell his New Jersey farm to Temple for less than he had paid, and he applied against the purchase price the decades of debts carefully recorded that William still owed him. He also took title to all of William's land claims in New York. Having taken William's son from him, he was now extracting his wealth and his connections to America. This final reunion of three generations of Franklin men, so fraught with father-son tensions, ended so coldly that none of them ever saw fit to discuss it. Franklin's journal offers not a word of detail, nor is there any record of his ever writing or telling about it. He and his son never corresponded again. William wrote a letter to his half-sister, Sally, 4 days later, but amazingly he rambled on about her children and a portrait he was trying to send her without ever describing the climactic scene. The closest he came at the end of the long letter was to lament, in discussing how everyone would soon be in Philadelphia, that my fate has thrown me on a different side of the globe. Even decades later, after his father and grandfather had both died, and he finally got around to producing a collection of his grandfather's life and works, Temple provided only a desultory and unrevealing phrase, noting that at Southampton, Franklin had the satisfaction of seeing his son, the former governor of New Jersey. William was not invited to the farewell party aboard his father's vessel on the evening of July 27th. Fully revitalized by travel, and showing no remorse over the cool parting with his son, Franklin stayed up with his friends until 4 a.m. When he awoke late that morning, his friends were gone, his two grandsons were with him, and his ship was already under sail for home. Chapter 16. Sage. Philadelphia, 1785 through 1790. Home at last. On this, his final voyage across the ocean, Franklin felt no need to study or even to mention the calming effect of oil on troubled waters. Nor, despite his many promises to friends, did he bring himself to work on his memoirs, which he had begun as a letter to the dear son he had just forsaken. Instead, he indulged the passion that both relaxed and invigorated his mind. Scientific inquiries awash with experimental details and practical consequences. The result was a 40-page gusher of observations and theories on a wide variety of maritime topics, replete with charts and drawings and data tables. At one point he paused, admitted that the garrulity of an old man has got hold of me, and then sailed forth. I think I might as well now once and for all empty my nautical budget. That budget was a full one. Theories, illustrated with diagrams, on how to design hulls to minimize their resistance to wind as well as water. Descriptions of his old experiments, along with proposals for new ones, on the effects of air currents on objects of various shapes. How to rig up sliced playing cards to gauge the effects of wind. How to translate that experiment into one using sails and booms. Ways to use pulleys to prevent anchor cables from breaking. An analysis of how ships fill with water after a leak. Proposals for compartmentalizing hulls the way the Chinese did. Tales from history about endangered ships that sank and those that survived, with speculations as to why. Learned comparisons of Eskimo kayaks, Chinese rowboats, Indian canoes, Bermuda sloops, and Pacific Island proas. Proposals for building water propellers and air propellers. And more, much more, for page after page, diagram after diagram. He also turned his attention to the Gulf Stream again. this time devising an experiment to test whether it extended to the depths or was more like a warm river flowing near the surface of the ocean. An empty bottle with a cork in its mouth was lowered to 35 fathoms, at which point the water pressure pushed the cork in and allowed the bottle to fill. The water, gathered from that depth, was 6 degrees cooler than that on the surface. A similar experiment using a keg with two valves found the water on the bottom, even at only 18 fathoms, to be 12 degrees cooler than the water at the surface. He provided temperature charts and maps, along with the suggestion that a thermometer may be a useful instrument to a navigator that could help captains catch a ride on the Gulf Stream going eastbound and avoid it westbound, thus potentially saving a week or more of travel. In addition, Franklin wrote papers, equally long and filled with experimental findings, on how to cure smoky chimneys and how to build better stoves. From a modern vantage, these treatises might seem obsessive in their immersion into details, but it must be remembered that they addressed one of the most serious issues of the time, the choking soot that plagued most homes and cities. It was altogether his most prodigious scientific outpouring since his electricity experiments of 1752. And like those previous studies, the ones he produced during his ocean crossing of 1785 showed his unique appreciation, that of an ingenious man, if not a genius, for combining scientific theory, technical invention, clever experiments, and practical utility. When Franklin and his two grandchildren arrived at Philadelphia's Market Street Wharf in September 1785, 62 years after he had first straggled ashore there as a 17-year-old runaway, "we were received by a crowd of people with huzzas and accompanied with acclamations quite to my door. Cannons boomed, bells rang, Sally embraced him, and tears ran down Temple's cheeks. Long worried about the damage the Lees and Adamses may have done to his reputation, Franklin was much relieved. The affectionate welcome I met with from my fellow citizens is far beyond my expectation," he proudly wrote John Jay. Gathered around him now at his Market Street home, even more than at Passy, would be that glorious assembly of family both real and adopted he always relished. There was his ever-dutiful daughter, Sally, who would play the role of his housekeeper, and her husband, Richard Bache, never successful but always accommodating. In addition to Benny and Willie, there were now four new Bache children. "Four little prattlers who cling about the knees of their grandpapa and afford me great pleasure," with another soon on the way. And within a year, Polly Stevenson would make good on her promise to come over, along with her three children. "As to my domestic circumstances," Franklin wrote Bishop Shipley, "they are at present as happy as I could wish them. I am surrounded by my offspring, a dutiful and affectionate daughter in my house, with six grandchildren." Benny enrolled at the Philadelphia Academy his grandfather had founded, by then renamed the University of the State of Pennsylvania, and on his graduation in 1787 became a full-time printer. Franklin was delighted, almost too much so. He built Benny a shop, helped him choose and cast fonts, and suggested books for him to publish. His knack for creating bestsellers like Poor Richard's Almanacs, however, had given way to a desire for more edifying and educational tomes, and Benny eventually began to squirm just a bit at his hovering presence. Yet he loyally served as Franklin's secretary and scrivener. Temple tried to turn himself into a gentleman farmer on the New Jersey estate that had just been wrested from his father, but he was temperamentally unsuited to caring much about crops and herds. In an ill-conceived attempt to create a showcase chateau, he pestered his French friends to send him specimen deer, American venison he declared tasteless, hunting dogs, and costumes for his workers. After the deer kept dying en route, Temple reverted to his urban dandy ways and spent most of his time on the party circuit in Philadelphia, while his grandfather, the only person to dote on him, continued his futile efforts to win him a ministerial appointment. Though less mobile than before, Franklin was as clubbable as he had been as a young tradesman, and the few surviving members of his old associations resumed their gatherings often at his house. There were only four left of the volunteer fire company he founded in 1736, but Franklin dug out his bucket and convened a meeting. The American Philosophical Society, which sometimes held sessions in his dining room, elected Temple a new member in 1786, along with most of the intellectual friends Franklin had made in Europe over the years, Le Veillard, La Rochefoucauld, Condorcet, Ingenhouse, and Cabanis, to apply the same earnest curiosity to the arduous and complicated science of government that the Philosophical Society applied to the science of nature, Franklin organized a companion group, the Society for Political Inquiries, whose members included his young activist friends such as Thomas Paine. Franklin had reached an age when he no longer fretted about squandering his time. For hours on end he would play cribbage or cards with friends, which caused him, he wrote Polly, to have brief twinges of guilt. "But another reflection comes to relieve me, whispering, 'You know the soul is immortal. Why, then, should you be such a niggard of a little time when you have a whole eternity before you?' So, being easily convinced and like other reasonable creatures satisfied with a small reason when it is in favor of doing what I have a mind to, I shuffle the cards again and begin another game." Finding the well-stocked farmer's market, which now extended to the third block of Market Street where he lived, an easier source of produce than growing his own, he turned his vegetable patch into a pocket passy garden with gravel paths, shrubs, and a shady mulberry tree. As one visitor recorded the new domestic scene, "We found him in his garden, sitting up a grass plot, under a very large mulberry tree, with several other gentlemen and two or three ladies. The tea table was spread under the tree, and Mrs. Bache, who is the only daughter of the doctor and lives with him, served it out to the company. She had three of her children about her. They seemed to be excessively fond of their grandpapa." It was a lifestyle that kept the gout at bay and, for the time being, his kidney stones from worsening. "He suffered pain only when he was walking or making water," he wrote Veillard. "As I live temperately, drink no wine, and use daily the exercise of the dumbbell, I flatter myself that the stone is kept from augmenting so much as it might otherwise do, and that I may still continue to find it tolerable. People who live long, who will drink the cup of life to the very bottom, must expect to meet with some of the usual dregs." 22 years earlier, he had personally overseen each detail of the construction of his new house on Market Street, and he even instructed Deborah from afar about the specifics of its decoration and furnishing. But he had lived in it for only brief intervals, and now he found it far too cramped for his extended family, club meetings, and entertaining. It was time, he decided, to embark on a new building spree. Despite his age, he found the prospect enticing.
He took joy in the details of design and craftsmanship. He had a passion for modern improvements and contrivances, and he relished the thrill of construction. As he wrote Veillard, he derived pleasure from overseeing the bricklayers, carpenters, stonecutters, painters, glaziers, whose craft he had first admired as a child in Boston. Plus, he knew that real estate was a good investment. Housing values were rising fast, as were rents. His plan was to demolish three older houses he owned on Market Street and replace them with two larger ones. He had wooed Deborah in one of them and worked as a fledgling printer in another, but nostalgia was not among his stronger sentiments. He was forced to change his plans, however, by a challenge to their property lines. "My neighbor disputing my bounds, I have been obliged to postpone until that dispute is settled by law," he wrote his sister Jane in Boston. "In the meantime, the workmen and materials being ready, I have ordered an addition to the house I live in, it being too small for our growing family." The new three-story wing, designed to meld seamlessly with the existing house, was 33 feet long and 16 feet wide, which enlarged his space by a third. On the ground floor was a long dining room, able to seat 24, and on the third floor were new bedrooms. The finest feature, which connected by a passage to my best old bedchamber, was a library that took up the entire second floor. With shelves from floor to ceiling, it accommodated 4,276 volumes, making it what one visitor claimed with some exaggeration, the largest and by far the best private library in America. As he confessed to Jane, "I hardly know how to justify building a library at an age that will soon oblige me to quit it. But we are apt to forget that we are grown old, and building is an amusement." Eventually, he was able to build the two new houses as well, one of which became Benny's printing shop, and he designed an arched passageway between them into the courtyard in front of his own renovated home, which was set back from Market Street. All the new construction allowed him to put into practice the various fire safety ideas he had advocated over the years. None of the wooden beams in one room connected directly to those in another. The floors and stairs were tightly plastered, and a trap door opened to the roof so one may go out and wet the shingles in case of a neighboring fire. He was satisfied to discover during the renovation of his main house that a bolt had melted the tip of its old lightning rod while he was in France, but the house had remained unscathed, so that at length the invention has been of some use to the inventor. Besides all his books, his new library boasted a variety of scientific paraphernalia, including his electricity equipment and a glass machine that exhibited the flow of blood through the body. For his reading comfort, Franklin built a great armchair set on rockers with an overhead fan that was powered by a foot pedal. Among his musical instruments were an harmonica, a harpsichord, a glassichord similar to his harmonica, a viola, and bells. From James Watt, the famed Birmingham steam engine maker, he imported and made some improvements on the first rudimentary copying machine. Documents would be written with a slow-drying ink made of gum arabic and then pressed on sheets of moist tissue paper to make copies for as long as the ink was still wet, usually a full day. Franklin, who had first used the machine in Passy, liked it so much that he ordered another that he gave to Jefferson. Franklin took special pride in one particularly handy invention,
a mechanical arm that could retrieve and replace books from upper shelves. He wrote a description of it, filled with drawings and diagrams and instructive tips, that was as detailed as the scientific treatises he had written on his ocean crossing. It was typical of Franklin. Throughout his life, he loved immersing himself in minutiae and trivia in a manner so obsessive that it might today be described as geeky. He was meticulous in describing every technical detail of his inventions, be it the library arm, stove, or lightning rod. In his essays, ranging from his arguments against hereditary honors to his discussions of trade, he provided reams of detailed calculations and historical footnotes. Even in his most humorous parodies, such as his proposal for the study of farts, the cleverness was enhanced by his inclusion of mock serious facts, trivia, calculations, and learned precedents. This penchant was on display in its most charming manner in a long letter he wrote to his young friend Kitty Shipley, daughter of the bishop, on the art of procuring pleasant dreams. It contained all of his theories, some more sound than others, on nutrition, exercise, fresh air, and health. Exercise should precede meals, he advised, not follow them. There should be a constant supply of fresh air in the bedroom. Methuselah, he reminded, always slept outdoors. He propounded a thorough, though not scientifically valid, theory of how air in a stifled room gets saturated and thus prevents people's pores from expelling putrid particles. After a full discourse on the science and pseudoscience, he provided three important ways to avoid unpleasant dreams. 1. By eating moderately, less perspirable matter is produced in a given time. Hence, the bedclothes receive it longer before they are saturated, and we may therefore sleep longer before we are made uneasy by their refusing to receive any more. 2. By using thinner and more porous bedclothes, which will suffer the perspirable matter more easily to pass through them, we are less incommoded, such being longer tolerable. 3. When you are awakened by this uneasiness and find you cannot easily sleep again, get out of bed, beat up and turn your pillow, shake the bedclothes well, with at least 20 shakes, then throw the bed open and leave it to cool. In the meanwhile, continuing undressed, walk about your chamber till your skin has had time to discharge its load, which it will do sooner as the air may be dried and colder. When you begin to feel the cool air unpleasant, then return to your bed and you will soon fall asleep, and your sleep will be sweet and pleasant. If you happen to be too indolent to get out of bed, you may, instead of it, lift up your bedclothes with one arm and leg, so as to draw in a good deal of fresh air, and by letting them fall, force it out again. This, repeated 20 times, will so clear them of the perspirable matter they have imbibed as to permit your sleeping well for some time afterwards. But this latter method is not equal to the former. Those who do not love trouble and can afford to have two beds will find great luxury in rising when they wake in a hot bed and going into the cool one. He concluded on a sweet note. There is a case in which the most punctual observance of them will be totally fruitless. I need not mention this case to you, my dear friend, but my account of the art would be imperfect without it. The case is when the person who desires to have pleasant dreams has not taken care to preserve what is necessary above all things, a good conscience. Pennsylvania was prospering at the time. "The crops are plentiful," he wrote a friend,
working people have plenty of employ. Yet, as usual, the state's politicians were split into two factions. On one side were the populists, made up mainly of local shopkeepers and rural farmers, who supported the very democratic state constitution with its directly elected unicameral legislature that Franklin had helped write. On the other side were those more frightened of rabble rule, including middle and upper-class property owners. Franklin fit philosophically in both camps. Both sought his support, and both he obliged. So both nominated him for the state executive council and then its presidency, the equivalent of the governorship, to which he was elected almost unanimously. Pleased to find that he was still so popular, Franklin took great pride in his election. "Old as I am," he told a nephew, "I am not yet grown insensible with respect to reputation." To Bishop Shipley he conceded that the remains of ambition from which I had imagined myself free had successfully seduced him. He also enjoyed the fact that after years of watching his reputation be pricked by partisan attacks, he could gain prestige by being above the fray. "He has destroyed party rage in our state," gushed Benjamin Rush after dining with him. "Or, to borrow an allusion from one of his discoveries, his presence and advice, like oil upon troubled waters, have composed the contending waves of faction." It was a talent that would soon serve him and his nation very well. The Constitutional Convention of 1787. The need for a new federal constitution became apparent, to those who wanted to notice, just a few months after the ratification of the Articles of Confederation back in 1781, when a messenger reached the Congress with the wondrous news of the victory at Yorktown. There was no money in the national treasury to pay the messenger's expenses, so the members had to pull coins from their own pockets. Under the Articles, the Congress had no power to levy taxes or do much of anything else. Instead, it attempted to requisition money from the states, the way colonial leaders had once wished the king would do, and the states, as the king and his ministers had once feared, often did not respond. By 1786, the situation was ominous. A former Revolutionary War officer named Daniel Shays led a rebellion of poor farmers in western Massachusetts against tax and debt collections, and there were worries that the anarchy would spread. The Congress, which was then meeting in New York, had been wandering from venue to venue, often unable to pay its bills or sometimes muster a quorum. The 13 states were indulging in their independence not only from Britain, but also from one another. New York imposed fees on all vessels coming from New Jersey, which retaliated by taxing a New York Harbor lighthouse on Sandy Hook. Other states were in the process of being formed, including one called Franklin, later renamed Tennessee, that struggled to sort out their potential relationship with the existing states. When the settlers who wished to form the new state of Franklin sought his advice on how to deal with the rival claims of North Carolina, he told them to submit the whole matter to Congress, which everyone knew would do little good. After Maryland and Virginia were unable to resolve some border and navigation disputes, a multi-state conference was convened in Annapolis to address them along with larger issues of trade and cooperation. Only 5 states attended, and little was accomplished. But James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, along with others who saw the need for a stronger national government,
used the gathering to call for a federal convention, ostensibly designed merely to amend the Articles of Confederation. It was scheduled for Philadelphia in May 1787. The stakes were enormous, as Franklin, who was selected as one of Pennsylvania's delegates, made clear in a letter he sent to Jefferson in Paris. "Our federal constitution is generally thought defective, and a convention, first proposed by Virginia and since recommended by Congress, is to assemble here next month to revise it and propose amendments. If it does not do good, it will do harm, as it will show that we have not the wisdom enough among us to govern ourselves." So they gathered in the abnormally hot and humid summer of 1787 to draft, in deepest secrecy, a new American Constitution that would turn out to be the most successful ever written by human hand. The men there formed, in Jefferson's famous assessment later, an assembly of demigods. If so, they were mainly young ones. Hamilton and Charles Pinckney were 29. Vain about his age as well as his wealth, Pinckney pretended to be 24 so he could pass for the youngest member, who was, in fact, Jonathan Dayton of New Jersey, 26. At 81, Franklin was the oldest member by 15 years, and exactly twice the average age of the rest of the members. When General Washington arrived in town on May 13th, his first act was to pay a call on Franklin, who opened his new dining room along with a cask of dark beer to entertain him. Among the many roles that Philadelphia's celebrated sage played at the convention was that of symbolic host. His garden and shady mulberry tree, just a few hundred yards from the State House, became a respite from the debates, a place where delegates could talk over tea, hear Franklin's tales, and be calmed into a mood of compromise. Among the 16 grand murals in the U.S. Capitol's Great Experiment Hall depicting scenes of historical importance, from the Mayflower Compact to the suffragette marches, is a garden scene of Hamilton, Madison, and James Wilson talking to Franklin under the shade of his mulberry tree. If his health permitted and ambition desired, Franklin could have been the only person other than Washington with a chance of becoming the chairman of the convention. He chose instead to be the one to nominate Washington. Unfortunately, heavy rains and a flare-up of his kidney stones made him miss the opening day, May 25th, so he asked another member of his delegation to nominate Washington. In his journal of the convention, Madison recorded that the nomination came with particular grace from Pennsylvania, as Dr. Franklin alone could have been thought of as a competitor. On Monday, May 28th, Franklin arrived to take his seat at one of the 14 round tables in the East Room of the State House, where he had spent so many years. According to some later accounts, it was a grand entrance. To minimize his pain, he was reportedly transported the block from his home in an enclosed sedan chair he had brought from Paris, which was carried by four prisoners from the Walnut Street jail. They held the chair aloft on flexible rods and walked slowly to prevent any painful jostling. Franklin's benign countenance and venerable grace as he took his seat every morning, and his preference for wry storytelling over argumentative oratory, added a calming presence. "He exhibits daily a spectacle of transcendent benevolence by attending the convention punctually," said Benjamin Rush, who added that Franklin had declared the convention the most august and respectable assembly he was ever in. Franklin could be doddering at times, a bit unfocused in his speeches, and occasionally baffling in a few of his suggestions. Still, the delegates usually respected him and always indulged him. This mix of feelings was tellingly recorded by one member, William Pierce of Georgia. "Dr. Franklin is well known to be the greatest philosopher of the present age. All the operations of nature he seems to understand. The very heavens obey him, and the clouds yield up their lightning to be imprisoned in his rod. But what claim he has to be a politician, posterity must determine. It is certain that he does not shine much in public counsel. He is no speaker, nor does he seem to let politics engage his attention. He is, however, a most extraordinary man, and tells a story in a style more engaging than anything I ever heard." Over the ensuing 4 months, many of Franklin's pet proposals, a unicameral legislature, prayers, an executive council instead of president, no salaries for office holders, were politely listened to and sometimes with a bit of embarrassment tabled. However, he brought to the convention floor three unique and crucial strengths that made him central to the historic compromise that saved the nation. First, he was far more comfortable with democracy than most of the delegates, who tended to regard the word and concept as dangerous rather than desirable. "The evils we experience," declared Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, "flow from the excess of democracy." "The people," Roger Sherman of Connecticut concurred, "should have as little to do as may be possible about government." Franklin was at the other end of the spectrum. Though averse to rabble rule, he favored direct elections, trusted the average citizen, and resisted anything resembling elitism. The Constitution he had drafted for Pennsylvania, with its popularly elected single-chamber legislature, was the most democratic of all the new states. Second, he was by far the most traveled of the delegates, and he knew not only the nations of Europe but the 13 states, appreciated both what they had in common and how they differed. As a postmaster, he had helped bind America together. He was one of the few men equally at home visiting the Carolinas as Connecticut, both places where he had once franchised print shops, and he could discuss, as he had done, indigo farming with a Virginia planter and trade economics with a Massachusetts merchant. Third, and what would prove most important of all, he embodied a spirit of enlightenment, tolerance, and pragmatic compromise. "Both sides must part with some of their demands," he preached at one point, in a phrase that would be his mantra. "We are sent hither to consult, not to contend with each other," he said at another. His disarmingly candid manner masked a very complex personality, the constitutional historian Richard Morris has written, but his accommodating nature would time after time conciliate jarring interests. These three attributes proved invaluable in resolving the core issues facing the convention. The greatest of these was whether America would remain 13 separate states or become one nation, or, if the demigods could prove so ingenious, some magical combination of both, as Franklin had first suggested in his Albany Plan of Union back in 1754. This issue was manifest in various specific ways. Would Congress be directly elected by the people or chosen by the state legislatures? Would representation be based on population or be equal for each state? Would the national government or the state governments be sovereign? America was deeply split on this set of issues. Some people, Franklin initially among them, were in favor of creating a supreme national government and reducing the states to a subordinate role. On the other side were those fervently opposed to any surrender of state sovereignty, which had been enshrined in the Articles of Confederation. The call for the convention expressly declared that its purpose would be to revise the Articles, not abandon them. The most radical proponents of states' rights even refused to attend. "I smell a rat," declared Patrick Henry. Samuel Adams justified his own absence by saying, "I stumble at the threshold. I meet with a national government instead of a federal union of sovereign states." The Virginia delegation, led by Madison and Edmund Randolph, arrived in Philadelphia early and proceeded to do just what the states' rights camp feared. They proposed scrapping the Articles entirely and starting afresh with a new constitution for a strong national government. It would be headed by a very powerful House of Representatives, elected directly by the people, based on proportional representation. The House would select members of an upper chamber, the president, and the judiciary. Franklin had long favored a legislature with only one directly elected House, seeing little reason to place checks on the democratic will of the people, and he had designed such a system in Pennsylvania. But in its first week, the convention decided this was, in fact, too democratic by half. Madison recorded, "The national legislature ought to consist of two branches, was agreed to without debate or dissent, except that of Pennsylvania, given probably from complaisance to Dr. Franklin, who was understood to be partial to a single house of legislation." One modification was made to the Virginia plan. To give the state governments some stake in the new Congress, the delegates decided that the upper chamber, dubbed the Senate after the Roman precedent, would be chosen by the state legislatures rather than by the House of Representatives. This procedure remained in effect until 1913. The central issue, however, remained unresolved. Would votes in the Houses of Congress be in proportion to population, or, as per the Articles of Confederation, equal for each state? The dispute was not only a philosophical one between proponents of a strong national government and those who favored protecting the rights of the states. It was also a power struggle. Little states, such as Delaware and New Jersey, feared they would be overwhelmed by the big states, such as Virginia and New York. The debate grew heated, threatening to break up the convention. And on June 11th, Franklin decided it was time to try to restore a spirit of compromise. He had written his speech in advance, and because of his health, asked another delegate to read it aloud. "Until this point about the proportion of representation came before us," he began, "our debates were carried on with great coolness and temper." After making his plea that members consult rather than contend, he expressed a sentiment that he had preached for much of his life, starting with the rules he had written for his junto 60 years earlier, about the dangers of being too assertive in debate. "Declarations of a fixed opinion and of determined resolution never to change it neither enlighten nor convince us," he said. "Positiveness and warmth on one side naturally beget their like on the other." He had personally been willing, he said, to revise many of his opinions, including the desirability of a unicameral legislature. Now it was time for all members to compromise. Franklin went on to propose a few suggestions, some of them sensible, others rather odd. He defended the idea of proportional representation, with the historical example of how Scotland, despite its smaller representation in the British Parliament, had avoided being overwhelmed by England. Then, with his love of detail, he provided a lengthy mathematical set of calculations showing how smaller states could garner enough votes to match the power of larger ones. There were other remedies to be considered. Perhaps the larger states could give up some of their land to the smaller ones. If it should be found necessary to diminish Pennsylvania, I should not be averse to the giving a part of it to New Jersey and another to Delaware. But if that was not feasible, he suggested an even more complex option. There could be equal tax contributions requisitioned from each state, and equal votes in Congress from each state on how to spend this money. Then a supplemental requisition from larger states with proportional votes in Congress on how to spend that fund. Franklin's speech was long, complex, and at times baffling. Were these all serious suggestions, or were some of them merely theoretical discourses? Members seemed not to know. He made no motion to vote on his suggestion for adjusting borders or creating separate treasury funds, nor did any of the other delegates. More important than his specific ideas was his tone of moderation and conciliation. His speech, with its openness to new ideas and absence of one-sided advocacy, provided time for tempers to cool. And his call for creative compromises had an effect. A few minutes later, Roger Sherman of Connecticut rose to suggest another possible approach. The House of Representatives